The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Monday Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. A couple of very quick announcements. One is there will be no Hotel Mars program this week. Mr. Bachelor has gone off to Poland and Israel, so don't expect Hotel Mars this week. And hopefully we'll be able to pull one off next week, although he is still going to be in Israel, but he thinks he can do it. So more on that later. And then for today's show with Dr. Landis, we're going to have an on-time ending at 3:30 California time, and that's going to be 6:30 Eastern. So if you want to get in a call or an email to Dr. Landis, gauge your time carefully, because we do need to have an on-time sharp ending at the 90-minute point. So that brings me to a couple of other things for the show today. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners, so just hang on the phone and wait until we bring you up on the air. And we do answer the phone during the break, and also we hold people over the break, or sometimes we skip the break. So if there's a break coming up, don't let that stop you from using the toll-free number. You can also reach us through email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and then you can post a comment on our blog, which is thespaceshow.com. All the way to the far right is the upcoming show menu. This is the first show on the upcoming show menu, and it is also the blog archive article for this particular show. So open that page up and scroll down to the bottom, which is where you offer comments. And as soon as you post a comment or a question for the show today, I will be able to bring it up on air. But again, the toll-free number, which I stress on every show, is our preferred way of communicating with our guest and asking questions. So remember, 1-866-687-7223. If you're outside the United States and cannot use the toll-free number, if you email me, I'll send you the actual phone number that you can direct dial so that you can get in your comment or question to our guest today. So at our website, thespaceshow.com, our newsletter is updated every Sunday after the Sunday show, so it is current, and you'll see the website newsletter center right on our homepage. And if you scroll down, you'll see all of the guests we have planned between now and the end of second quarter 2018. We're still filling in a couple of spaces remaining on second quarter 2018. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website or very rapidly download the show. And then in the upper left, there's an important menu under support. This is where our store is for T-shirts, coffee mugs, things of that nature. And then there's also listen live instructions. So this you can share with people. It tells you how to listen to live shows for people who don't know how to do that. And how to listen to archive programs as MP3s off of our website. And then podcasting off of our various podcasting servers and your device that you may be using. And then for those of you using Alexa, it has the embedded tune-in player, so you can use Alexa to hear Space Show programs. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me. Center right on the homepage is, to me, as I always say, the most important part. This is where we talk about supporting the Space Show. Remember, we are a listener-supported program. We're a 501c3 nonprofit with one O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. Your contributions to the Space Show keep us on the air. So if you like what you hear, you like our blog, you like our guest, you even may like me, do support us, because without that support, we won't be here. So PayPal and mailing check instructions are available. There are also Amazon programs for nonprofits, of which we're registered, and you can use those to support the Space Show. Just click on the big Amazon link. And if you have any questions, read the website for our parent, which is the 501c3, onegiantleapfoundation.org, or just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then we also have sponsorship. So remember, sponsors get a banner ad going across our homepage. You can change that ad as often as you want. And you can get a short 60-second or less message read by me on air, and I read them during the first segment and the second segment of the program. So for today, on the first segment, the Space Development Network is one of our sponsors. This is an online group that allows you, the advocate, to join together with others to advance the plan for space development. And they need people with a variety of interest and skills. It's free to join, so check it out at spacedevelopment.org. The Space Foundation sponsors us. Their 34th symposium is next week in Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor Hotel, April 16th through the 19th. Great networking, a lot of substantive information, very international in scope. And their website for one-stop-all shopping, it's not too late to make reservations, spacesymposium.org. And then don't forget the Integrated Space Plan, which is the highly developed flowchart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. There are hundreds of individual elements in the plan. If you go to it online, thespaceplan.com, lots of interactive activities on their website as well. You can buy a full-size copy of the plan. There's two different versions, an academic version and the general version. All of this at their website, thespaceplan.com. So I'm very, very happy to bring back one of our favorite guests on the Space Show, Dr. Jeffrey Landa. He is both a scientist and a sci-fi writer. And as a writer, he's the author of some 80 published short stories, novelettes, and around 50 poems. One of his novels, Mars Crossing, appeared from Tor Books, and a short story collection, Impact Parameter and Others, came from Golden Cyprin. He's won incredible awards. In addition to his award-winning science fiction work, he is a scientist at NASA's Glenn Research Center, and he has also won many awards. He's been a visiting professor. He has over 400 scientific papers. He has patents. He's an authority in photovoltaics and astronautics. I posted his full bio, which is 2 pages, and I don't want to read the 2 pages. I want to talk with Jeff. But I suggest you go to our website and click on his name, and you can read his full bio. You can see the missions that he's worked on, and we're going to talk to him. So, Dr. Landis, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you today? Are you there? Did I lose him already? Jeff, I can't hear you. Are you there?
Hi, how are you doing?
Oh, fine. I thought I lost you.
Yeah.
Can you hear us now okay?
Yeah, I can hear you now okay. Thanks.
So welcome to the show, and we're glad to have you back. So in some of the material you sent me, I noticed that you're winning Phase 2 NIAC Awards. So why don't we start there, okay?
Yeah, I've been actually spending quite a bit of my time working with some of these NASA's Innovative Advanced Concepts projects, and they've been a heck of a lot of fun, actually.
Which ones have you been, what are you working on, what have you gotten your awards on?
Well, the one that we just are going to be getting the Phase 2 on is a project called Triton Hopper. So that's a project to explore Neptune's moon Triton, one of the most interesting objects in the solar system. Another one that we just sort of finished doing our recent work on has been the submarine for Titan. That one, Steve Olson's is the man for that. He's the submarine guy. But it's been a lot of fun working on that, too, sort of going to extreme environments in the outer solar system.
So how do you get these missions to actually happen? For example, how do you get to Triton to implement your Hopper idea?
Well, actually, getting to Triton is tough. You think, well, it's hard enough to get to Mars, but Triton is out by Neptune, and that is billions of miles away, not mere hundreds of millions. So you're right, that's a tricky question. In the first phase of the project, we got there using a combination of solar electric propulsion and then a gravity slingshot by Jupiter. So that's it got us there. It's a little bit slow. Of course, once you get to the outer solar system, the solar propulsion doesn't work very well, so we're doing all of our thrusting in the inner solar system and then mostly coast when we pass Jupiter.
Do they have any missions that you can do this on, or do you have to fight to try to get an actual mission to go there? What is that process like?
There has been a lot of interest recently, kind of new interest, in these outer planets. They sometimes call them the ice giants, Uranus and Neptune. They've sort of been ignored for just years and years. We had the Voyager flyby go past them, and that was it. That was all that we really knew about them. But now people are thinking about them again, so we're kind of hoping that we can get some excitement going and get it into the NASA plan to get a mission out to the ice giants.
So does the Triton Hopper mean you actually land on Triton with a lander?
Yes, exactly. Triton is it's a moon, but it's a big moon. It's bigger than Pluto. So if it were out by itself in the outer solar system, we'd actually call it a dwarf planet. It's a lot like Pluto, in fact. It has nitrogen glaciers. So our idea was that we could use these nitrogen glaciers to refuel. So not only do we want to land on Triton, but we then want to refuel and take off and fly to a different location and keep doing that. The idea was actually to have true equator-to-pole mobility. We haven't quite gotten our concept to equator-to-pole, but maybe as we keep working in phase two, we're going to get that much mobility.
So you want to move all around the moon, Triton. You don't want to just stay in one place.
Yeah, the way we've often done things is we start missions to planets with just landers that sit in one place. But what we've really discovered is that, man, if you can have a rover that moves around, you can really learn a lot more about a place by looking at more than just one spot on a planet. Triton has some very amazingly different terrain. It goes from the sort of dimpled cantaloupe terrain in some places to glaciers of frozen nitrogen, places where we have nitrogen snow, and then even toward the South Pole, we have places where there's geysers. So liquid nitrogen geysers, how cool is that?
be really cool if you could actually get there and explore it, right?
We are so hoping we can do that, yeah.
How long would it take to actually, once you launch, to get to Triton? I mean, this has got to be many, many years, right, of flight?
Yeah, our first thinking took us about 12 years to get all the way out to Triton. We're hoping as we move into the phase two and start looking at some other kind of more advanced concepts, we might be able to carve that down a little bit. As I said, in the phase one, the concept design, we designed a vehicle that was a solar electric propulsion vehicle. In phase two, there's some new nuclear technology that NASA's just beginning to get out of the out of the viewgraph engineering and into the real world. So there's a new nuclear reactor called Kilopower, and we're thinking that we can use that nuclear reactor for a nuclear electric propulsion rocket, where the nuclear reactor powers an ion engine.
Funny you mention that. I have the guy who wrote the paper on that coming on the show. I forget his name, but he's also at NASA. He just got permissions to come on the show, and he's coming on in a couple of weeks.
Excellent. Yeah, it's funny. I've spent much of my career working on solar power, but I am a nuclear power advocate. My theory is we need appropriate technology, and there's certainly places in the solar system where nuclear power is the right type of technology to use.
Well, everyone, you're saying everyone is, of course, maybe a blanket overstatement, but the vast majority of space show listeners have for years been strongly advocating nuclear propulsion, and I think we've talked to you about it before, and it doesn't happen. We don't even seem to get close to it, and most people say it's because of the word nuclear and the fear factor. I don't know if that's true. I just think it's inept and politicians that don't give a damn. Is it really a fear factor that stops us from doing this?
It is hard to tell. We certainly use radioisotope sources a lot for our solar system exploration once we get to Mars and beyond. The radioisotopes, of course, are somewhat different. They're not actually nuclear reactors, but they're isotopes that stay hot, and we do thermal energy conversion from that isotope power. So it's not that we don't use nuclear sources at all in space, but the isotope power systems are very small. They're, you know, tens to hundreds of watts, whereas a real nuclear reactor would get up to tens to hundreds of kilowatts. So that actually turns out to be kind of a problem with nuclear reactors is that you can't really start small. There aren't tiny little nuclear reactors. The smallest nuclear reactors are getting to be the tens of kilowatts. So it's nice when you're doing something to have kind of an incremental step. But the first step for a nuclear reactor is a pretty big one.
Well, but you're also looking for power for propulsion, so that probably requires a lot of energy, too.
We're looking for power and propulsion. Of course, nuclear power would be magnificent for something like a moon base. If you're putting a lunar base up, well, you need power, and nighttime's awfully long on the moon, unless you can find that mythical peak of eternal light, which might make solar possible.
But it's on the moon. Why should people be afraid of that here on Earth?
I don't think they should. In fact, nuclear reactors in space are even safer than things that we fly every day, because the interesting thing about a nuclear reactor is it's not radioactive until you turn it on. So it's quite safe. It's a good technology. I'm all in favor of it.
One wonders why it doesn't receive the attention that so many people would like it to receive.
Well?
And I don't think I like any of the answers. I don't think they're really good answers.
Well, if you can solve that problem, let me know, because I think it's a technology that we really could use.
You have a question already from a listener via email. Doug is in Southern California, and he says there are a number of solar system bodies that are roughly within the gravitational range of Triton. So might a Triton-class lander be useful for exploring other bodies?
Well, yes. The same type of system that we can land on Triton could also probably be used as a refuelable hopper on pretty much any of the icy moons or beyond that into the Kuiper Belt. In the project that we're just about to start, one thing we've been thinking about is saying, well, let's see if we can't go to actually Pluto. I just said that Triton is a lot like Pluto, but we can reverse that and say Pluto's a lot like Triton. So if we can get something that has mobility on Triton, we can probably also move around on Pluto. And what we've learned is, my, Pluto is a fascinating world. Who would have thought it would be so interesting?
Again, somebody has to allocate the funding and the mission to do all of this. Where do these kinds of missions stack up in priorities to the people who actually plan these missions? Or how is it all done through the Decadal Survey, or is there really some mythical committee there that says we're doing this, this, and this?
At NASA recently, they have been very serious about paying attention to the Decadal Survey. The NASA Decadal Survey, in case for people who aren't aware of it, is where the scientists that advise NASA all throw in their input and say, these are the missions that we want to do, this is all the science we want to do, and it kind of prioritizes what the most important science is. So the first thing is to make sure, of course, that outer planets and outer planet moons are there in the decadal survey. That basically means that the scientists have looked at it and given it some very careful thought and said, yes, this is a pretty high priority. So that will be coming up. The next decade is getting here pretty close. So we're hoping we can be influential in the next decadal survey.
You have an email. We may never get back to our planned opening. George is in New Haven. And as I told you before the show started, your previous comments and your work on Venus really have captured people. So George says, when are we actually going back to Venus to do more work and to explore the settlement idea of Cloud City, which you have talked about before? That seems so much easier and more rational than trying to start a settlement on Mars. Isn't there any broader interest in Venus?
Yes, Venus is getting to be one of my favorite planets because it is a so fascinating planet, so much like the Earth in some ways and so radically different from the Earth in others. You may have seen Venus in the news recently. A lot of people all of a sudden have discovered something that the astrobiologists have been talking about for many years, but the fact that there are particles in the upper atmosphere of Venus that we don't even know what they are. They cause the UV darkening, the sort of patterns in the clouds that we see in UV images, and nobody even knows what these particles are. But some people have been pointing out that, well, these particles have the same reflectance spectra as bacteria. So they're saying, well, how do we know that there isn't bacteria in that kind of habitable zone in the upper atmosphere of Venus, where the temperature and the pressure get very much Earth-like? So, yeah, I love all of the solar system. It is a fascinating place, but I am also a great advocate of going back to Venus.
Well, if we don't know what they are, how do we detect them?
Well, we can see them in the ultraviolet. These are particles that are dark in the ultraviolet. And I say particles, but of course we don't really have a good feel for them.
Now, is this something new? Because we've had ultraviolet for a long, long time.
Yeah, no, it's actually been known since the days of the Pioneer orbiters. We've been sort of looking at these dark markings in the upper atmosphere of Venus, dark in the ultraviolet, of course.
Uh-huh.
But all of a sudden, people have been really beginning to take seriously that belief that, well, maybe these particles are, maybe they are bacteria. It's not out of the question. I should credit some other people, by the way. That's not my science. I didn't invent the idea that they might be bacteria. David Grinspoon, for example. You've had David on the show, haven't you?
Right, and I'm actually talking about his latest book with Alan Stern on Sunday.
Ah, okay.
That about Pluto, about Chasing New Horizons.
Ah, yeah. So David Grinspoon was one of the very early people pointing out that, this upper atmosphere of Venus is very Earth-like, and that could have life in the upper atmosphere of Venus. He pointed that out in his book, Venus Revealed.
Given what I think you've indicated before, if I'm saying it wrong, you can obviously correct me. But since some sort of settlement in the upper atmosphere would be more Earth compatible than going to Mars, why are we not seeing any kind of a space settlement movement to go to Venus, even by the private sector?
Well, I think we should. The first thing we need to do, of course, is just go back to Venus with a robotic spacecraft. We've been doing that with orbiters lately, and when I say me, we've been doing it. What I mean is the planet Earth has been doing it.
Uh-huh.
These have been European and Japanese orbiters. But we really need to go into the atmosphere again, sort of float in the atmosphere with balloons or perhaps fly in the atmosphere with airplanes. We need to learn more about Venus, find out what it's like.
So when you say airplanes and balloons, you're not speaking about airplanes and balloons as we know them here on Earth, are you?
Well, very similar, interestingly enough, because when you get above the thick cloud layer, above the thick middle cloud layer, as I said, it gets very Earth-like. So the airplanes that you might fly in Venus would look a lot like Earth airplanes. Balloons that might float in the atmosphere of Venus would look a lot like Earth balloons. So it's an environment that is pretty compatible with humans.
So would it be easier for, I'm just throwing this out at random, a Falcon 9 or Falcon Heavy rocket to get to Venus with a meaningful payload or Mars?
Venus and Mars are relatively similar in how hard they are to get to. Venus is a little bit harder to stop when you get there because you're dropping downward into the gravity well. Mars is a little bit harder to get to, and Mars takes a little bit longer. It's about an 8 to 9 month trip to Mars. It's a shorter trip to Venus.
But since you're not going to land on the surface on Venus, because you probably wouldn't last very long, and you're trying to land a big payload on the surface of Mars, you're saying it would not be easy to stop at, what, 50,000 feet in the upper atmosphere of Venus? Or?
Well, Venus does have that advantage. It has the thick atmosphere. So if you can use the atmosphere to brake, to aerobrake and come in, parachutes, of course, work very, very well on Venus, and they work on Mars, but you're still going pretty fast, even with a big parachute. So in some sense, once you get to Venus, entering the atmosphere is in some ways a little bit easier on Venus than on Mars.
You already have a caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show today. Who are you and where are you, please?
I'm Don Davis in California.
Oh, hi, Don. How are you doing?
Quite well. I want to take advantage of every opportunity to speak to the all-too-rare Venus fans among us.
Well, we're few, but we're getting more and more in number. People are paying attention to Venus now.
I want to see more looks at the surface. And, of course, you came up with an elegant and relatively simple land sailing design for a Venus rover, which I found intriguing.
Yes, that was also a NIAC project. That was one that we're probably going to propose for a phase two with the call next year. We were too busy with other projects to propose a phase two this year. But we're excited by that, too.
I hope the camera is getting as much attention as possible in the ideal, at least that I would have, of obtaining color views from the surface, panoramic views, and such.
Yeah, high-temperature camera turns out to be a tricky design problem, but we think that it's a solvable design problem. In fact, we have a project at NASA Glenn. There's a project they call Rocket University for the relatively new employees. They're not actual university students. They're NASA employees, but they're the new employees. And they're, in fact, right now working on trying to make a camera for Venus, and that would be a real help to get a good camera.
Absolutely. And an ideal stretch the envelope even further. Of course, me as the artist with my love of visual input, I'm going to keep making unreasonable demands on the technology. But I want to see ultimately a rover with a video camera and a microphone that can give us an impression of what Venus would be like on the surface that would have life to it, so to speak. The sound should conduct rather well in the atmosphere if you're close to something like a volcano. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine something that would be more exciting if one could get reasonably close to an active volcano and videotape it.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool. At the moment, I don't think we have a good feel for which of the many, many volcanoes on Venus are active, or indeed actually whether any of them are.
On it, so
we assume they must be, but we don't know which ones.
What about the one, I can't remember the name, that there's a big, a honking hot spot right at the exact spot of the volcano, which suggested fresh lava flows?
Yeah, it was
anyway.
That was an ESA Venus Express result you're talking about.
I believe so, yes. It was this very prominent hotspot coinciding with a fresh-looking volcano.
That is a pretty interesting clue indeed. We've got to get down there and look. That's all there is to it. We've been looking orbit from long enough. We've got to get down there and look from close up.
It's been too long. The Soviets did a wonderful job managing to get our first glimpses of the surface of another world with Venus. And now, I've looked around online at the high-temperature industrial video cameras, and there are designs that look rated to work at Venus temperatures, but they're all cool designs. Now, I remember a designed for a rover, or at least hearing of one, that's sort of the opposite extreme of the elegant simplicity of yours, but of a fairly massive atomic-powered refrigerated rover that could last for weeks on the surface. Do you recall such a proposal?
Yeah, actually, I think that one was mine, too. I can send you the paper if you want. We did a lot of work.
Sure, I would. I'll do a painting of what it
okay.
looked like.
Okay, yeah, we did several different designs for the idea of trying to make a refrigerated chamber. And that was actually one of the reasons that pushed us to try to go the opposite way, to do the very lightweight and low-power rover.
Uphill struggle, eh?
Because it ended up just every time we did more details to the design, it kept getting bigger and heavier and more expensive. But looking at that approach, too, the idea that we can have a radioisotope power system on Venus with enough power output that it could run a refrigerator that could keep a volume of the rover, keep a volume cool.
See, that could make the more elaborate imaging and maybe, you know, other electronic sensors more of a viable idea, but as you say, it seemed to be an uphill struggle, and better to find out on the drawing board than in the development phase of a project, I guess. I guess one final thing, there's been thoughts about sending balloons and such that could hop up and down the surface and obtain views as well. And I worry that the lighting is so even from horizon to zenith from the cloud deck that you really wouldn't see much more than albedo details with the haze diminishing it, the visibility with distance, unless you were right on the surface, and the lighting would be so bad that you'd need stereo imaging from substantially different locations to see much of the topography. But all these plans for our future landers, I think, need to wait until we get a much better radar map of the entire planet in order to better characterize both the past and future potential landing sites.
Yeah, well, people have also been talking about trying to get better radar images. Magellan was pretty impressive. That was a nice experiment, but it would be nice
Absolutely.
To get higher resolution indeed.
Absolutely. And the Venera orbiters were actually not that bad. When you look at their data sets, they complement Magellan's nicely with a different radar direction and such. But definitely, the more that we can learn about our closest neighbor world, I think it will be very beneficial. I'm afraid that Venus doesn't get much respect. I'm afraid it's partly because there's no prospects of sending people there, and so nobody cares. But really, an exotic, energetic world with things happening on the surface that's right next door. I just I hope I get that we live to see new vistas from the hostile surface of our nearest neighbor.
Yeah, I hope so too. So far, Venus has not won any of the NASA competitions for missions. We've been hopeful and gotten close many times, but not won. But maybe next time around we'll get a Venus mission. I'm looking forward to that.
Hopefully, one day the comparative neglect, will be noticeable. Take care.
Thank you, Don. Are there any Venus missions planned by anyone right now that you know of? Is anything on the books?
There's nothing that is quite on the book, but there's a mission that is almost on the book. That's a Russian mission called Venera D. The Russians, of course, have had tremendous successes with Venus. They've been doing brilliant work back in the 1980s. And they are proposing to their, basically, funding agencies that they might do a continuation and do a longer-lived mission to Venus. So a lot of the scientists that I know are pretty excited that the Russians might get the funding to do a new Venera mission.
Interesting. Jake in San Antonio, I'm going to go ahead and read his question, but I kind of think it's frivolous, but maybe it's serious.
Well, frivolous questions
for Jake.
He
says, would Venus gain a lot in substantial interest priority and mission planning if Mr. Musk announced that he's decided to retire on Venus and go to Venus
instead of retiring
Mars?
On Mars?
Yeah.
I bet a lot of people would start thinking about Venus if Elon Musk said, yes, skip Mars, let's go to Venus. If anybody knows Elon, call him up and say, hey, I have an idea for you.
Well, maybe that'll be a fallback. Adrian is in San Diego with a question and a follow-up already. Can you please ask your guest if he would like to expand on his statement that nuclear reactors are not radioactive until they are turned on? He might want to explain what exactly he means as to the production of the fission products versus the actual radioactivity of the initial fuel isotopes.
Well, of course, I could explain a little bit of the nuclear engineering if it's exciting. The uranium isotopes for nuclear reactors are in and of themselves not terribly radioactive. The point of a uranium isotope is that it undergoes fission when you hit it with a neutron, and then it also releases neutrons. So you have the famous chain reaction where you hit one uranium atom with a neutron. It produces more neutrons, which produce more fissions. But nothing really happens until you start that reaction. It's mostly just the not terribly radioactive uranium. Once, however, you start the reaction, it does get radioactive, and partly it's because of these fission products. You make radioisotopes that are unstable as a byproduct of fission, and partly because, of course, when it's turned on, you're producing all of these neutrons and gamma rays. So you don't really want to stand right next to a nuclear reactor when it is doing its nuclear reaction.
And when you're talking about turning on, you're mm-hmm. making sure the launch vehicle is out of Earth's atmosphere and on its way before
yes,
it gets
absolutely.
Activated.
In general, that's what people consider as well. We'll put nuclear reactors only in a very high orbit that won't decay for thousands or millions of years. Or even better, turn the nuclear reactor on after it's left the Earth's gravity well completely, so you're flying away with it.
And his follow-up question was, when looking at the design of your Venus rover, the thing that really stands out is that its legs are so very long that the body is high above the ground. Why? Oh, and this is from Doug, by the way. I'm sorry. I forgot to tell you that.
Oh, yeah, he must be looking at the older Venus rovers. We did that because we wanted something that could, if necessary, lift up the legs and climb over rough ground. So we want the center of gravity pretty high. One of the real possible failure modes of a rover is when you rub the bottom of the rover against a rock. So the higher off the ground you are, the easier it is to avoid getting stuck. So we tend to do that in our designs.
Aside from Venus and Mars, do you have any other places where you think would be absolutely great for humans to visit or live at or possibly have a colony?
Well, Ultimately, I'd like to see humans all the way through the solar system. I don't think there's any place that we can't live. An old, old staple of science fiction used to be asteroid mining. So there were always the great science fiction stories about going into the asteroid belt to mine resources. And I'm still excited by that. I think there are resources in the asteroid belt. They may not be the classic resources that funded the exploration of the West, of the American West, which was gold and silver. But there's a lot of resources in the asteroid belt if you're going to be settling space, because the asteroid belt has a lot of objects with very low gravity wells, so it's easy to harvest resources. Some of the resources are actually going to be very mundane things, things that we don't even think of hardly as valuable at all, things like water. But going to the asteroid belt and just harvesting water would be very valuable. And then, of course, building materials like aluminum, steel, glass. Those are all things that one might harvest. So I could certainly see colonies out in the asteroid belt just involved in harvesting these materials that will be valuable for building space colonies, for building the infrastructure.
So if I can find it, I'm looking for a Space Show blog post that was actually made about a different show, but it's I think it's appropriate for me to ask you about this. This is from a gentleman in Germany, Matt, if I can find it real quickly. And he is arguing that, here it is, that space settlement and living in space, I'm not going to read it, but I can refer to it, is not possible for humans because you can't survive without oxygen. You need this, that, and the other to survive your environment. You need that you can't compare this to things like being on the space station or submarines, because these are highly trained crews with lots of support and infrastructure and things of that nature, and that it's not natural for humans to think that they can live on a settlement in space. And then he talks about the failures of Biosphere 2 as a model, and then he says, now I'm not talking about a small scientific outpost on the moon or maybe Mars or something like that for a very few people for a short period of time, but for the most part, humans are not qualified is the wrong word, but are not really built to be living in space and get over it.
Well, that's a pessimistic view. There is some truth to the part that says this is not easy. When we read science fiction, I have to say I love science fiction, but science fiction makes it seem easy. There is a lot of challenges. We will be going into an environment where pretty much every single component of your life support, all the things that you don't think about, is going to have to be engineered. You can build a house here on Earth, and you just live with the fact that you say, oh, yes, you have oxygen in the air. You have food to eat that comes in. You have ways to dispose of waste. And in space, every single portion of that, somebody is going to have to engineer and figure, how do you do this? Where is your oxygen coming from? Where is your food coming from? Who purifies your water? Who purifies your air? Where do your waste products go? How do you recycle the waste products? So that is a hard project, but I would say that just because it's hard doesn't mean it's impossible. And I think it's good to do things that are hard. In fact, I'd almost say that it's our duty as human beings to go out there and do the hard challenges, that we don't just do things that are easy. But we have to do it one step at a time.
So are we a long ways off from being able to really have a space settlement like they're talking, 2030s for Mars maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Is that even, in your opinion, plausible? I mean, we might get to Mars with people in 2030, but I'm talking about having a viable space settlement.
If we chose to do it, we could do it in several decades. It's a question of sort of building up the capabilities step by step. And keep in mind, we've been living in space since the year 2000. The people in college today have never lived in a world that has not had humans living and working in orbit. So that's so step by step, we are making steps. They're baby steps, but we're making steps. But yes, it's a matter of decades. It's not a matter of next year or the year after. It's a long, slow process, step by step.
And of course, we're living in space anyway on Earth. It's just,
we're
protected from space, so to speak.
Yeah, well, that's a good insight. Of course, Earth is part of space. It's the planet.
In terms of settlements and all of this kind of stuff, many people say the only way we're going to do this, and I don't know your thoughts on this, I'd really like to hear them, is gene therapy. Let's modify the human genome so that we're adaptable to space, and some of these hard issues may not be as hard or maybe easier to mitigate. Your thoughts on genetically modifying a human to live in space?
Yeah, in the long term, that is a solution that might be the most far-ranging solution. I love the idea. I'd love to read more science fiction that talks about it. It's just not something that I can talk about very much because, in fact, I'm not a biologist. I like to listen when people talk about these ideas, but gene therapy is beyond my capability.
Well, you know, I go to gene therapy lectures with people dealing with CRISPR and other things,
mm-hmm.
And I talk about this on the show all the time, because I have a cystic fibrosis son, and CF is one of the genetic illnesses that gets a lot of research attention in this area because apparently it's prime for some possible genetic modification along with Huntington's disease and one
mm-hmm.
or two other things. So I listen to the guys from
mm-hmm.
Berkeley and Stanford and Harvard and what they're saying about it, and they really can't even modify something here on Earth, but they kind of think they know how to do it, and maybe it's not too far away, and tools like CRISPR make it more plausible, but that they don't make it happen. And, you know, so the list of potentials making it sort of near term grows and grows, but the reality of getting it closer and closer doesn't sort of grow and grow. And that's nothing compared to trying to modify someone to live in space.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when their lectures end, I go up and ask them, you know, are they ever contacted? Do they ever give any thought to? Have they ever been, you know, approached about genetically modifying a human to live in artificial gravity or space with radiation? And of course, they have blank stares on their faces, like, what kook farm did you come off of? But it's they all say, you know, I guess it's possible, but right now we can't even do this for a disease that we pretty well understand. And we think we're getting closer, but we're really not there. Although I do understand there have been some simple modifications in Huntington's disease that have made some differences. But that's a far cry from modifying a human for spaceflight.
Yes, I think right now we don't even know what we need to know yet. But the thing about biology is it is making tremendous gains very quickly. So perhaps if we wait, it'll be something that will astound us. But at the moment, it is science fiction still.
You have another phone call, but Sarah's in Seattle, and she says, I just heard you mention how rapidly biology is making gains. Would you like to compare gains being made in physics to gains being made in biology? Is one moving faster than the other?
Oh, that really is your example of an apples and oranges comparison, all right. They are so completely different. Biology, of course, surrounds us, and in fact, it is us. And it is so wonderful and complex and very, very subtle. And physics, of course. There's still a lot to learn in physics as well, but I'm not sure if I do have a good comparison between the two. We're learning different things in biology and physics.
Do we learn it at different rates, or that's not really a relevant question?
Well, we learn different kinds of things. Physics has been telling us now things, among other things, about the very early universe, the very first moments of our universe. And, of course, life on Earth didn't start coming about until the universe was already well over 10 billion years old. So we're looking at different things. Biology is the study of the incredibly complex organisms that have evolved over 500 million years to a astounding level of complexity. So to some extent, my hat is off to the biologists because they're studying a subject that is so, you know, amazingly complex.
An email from Adrian. The fact that Venus doesn't appear to contain a magnetic field of any significance would imply that it also, being closer to the sun, would have a high degree of radiation, solar wind exposure, especially in the upper atmosphere. How would this impact theories of the possibility of any kind of life to survive in such a high radiation and UV exposure environment in the upper atmosphere?
Yes, the radiation environment is something always to think about. It's not as bad on Venus as you would think. The solar particles, the solar wind protons, and even the occasional coronal mass ejection particles do get stopped by the atmosphere of Venus. It has enough atmosphere to stop solar wind particles. The galactic cosmic rays, of course, penetrate a little bit more, and we don't have a deflecting magnetic field. But even there, there's in the level of Venus that we're talking about, we still have about the equivalent of 10 tons of protection per square meter. So you're underneath quite a bit of just sheer material protection. So it's not a harsh radiation environment at all. The ultraviolet, of course, is something that you might want to worry about. Earth has oxygen in the atmosphere, free oxygen. That gives us an ozone layer, and that shields out some of the worst of the ultraviolet. So you might want to wear sunscreen if you're going outside on Venus, but then I wouldn't suggest going outside in your bare skin anyway.
You have another caller on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim.
Hello.
Go for it.
Hi, Dr. Landis. I wanted to ask, since one of the things you're really known for is alternative propulsion systems, advanced propulsion, I play at a very simple level with skyhooks, and mm-hmm. One of the papers of yours I really like is about sling launchers. And I think sometimes about mass drivers. And I had this impression, and I wondered if you would have an opinion on how true this is and what it might mean, that rockets are great, but if we're going to have an economy in space, if we're going to really have large colonies, that having those kinds of transport systems make a big difference, and that you can't really have scale without something like that. What would you say about that kind of idea?
Oh, I will agree with you entirely that the sort of sling launchers, tethers, rotating tethers, and even perhaps the electrodynamic tethers open up a lot of possibility. They open up the possibility of transport that doesn't require the use of massive amounts of rocket fuel, and you can get away from that exponential rocket equation. So if you're moving large amounts of things around in space, and why wouldn't you want to? It really is a good idea if you can do it with some of these remarkably simple systems, actually, that use tethers, that use slings, and can push things around without using up fuel and just conserving the momentum instead of throwing it away.
All those variants on tethers, they don't, I mean, there's lots of ideas out there, but they don't ever seem to get funding. Could you talk about what's going on there? Is it just not time yet? What are the factors there?
Yeah, it's a good question, and if I really had a good answer to the question of why some ideas sort of stall out and don't move on, I'd really like to know the answer myself. Tethers had some very interesting experiments back in the 1980s, some of which showed very good results. Unfortunately, two of the most prominent experiments, not even necessarily the best experiments, but the prominent ones, the TSS experiments flown on the space shuttle, did have problems, and that has been remaining in people's minds. They remember the failures and not the successes. Something people worry about with tether-type systems is they do worry about space debris, and they worry about space debris both directions. They worry about tethers being hit by space debris, and they also worry about tethers causing space debris. And that's been more and more of a problem lately as people are really thinking about, we're beginning to put a lot of stuff in orbit. Maybe we should worry about what happens when it hits something.
This maybe is a question that's too specific. It may go back to work that you've done too long ago. But the kinds of materials that we have now, is it reasonable to think that they would work in space, things like Kevlar and Xylon and Aramid? I just play with the idea in order to look at it. But when I go and propose something, thinking around the moon, and think of materials like that, then I wonder, I really have no idea if a structure like that would last for very long. Is there really a lot of research to do on it? Can we know about that?
Yes, different environments have different problems. When you're looking at environments close to the Earth, so things that might be deployed in low Earth orbit, you have to worry about atomic oxygen. Atomic oxygen is going to chew away any tethers that are made of organic materials, like, for example, the spectra, the polyimides, the Kapton-like things. The solution to that is that you will probably have to coat the outside of the tether with some sort of protective barrier coating that prevents the environment from getting at the tether. Likewise, you're going to have to worry a little bit about radiation damage for the polymer tethers. Radiation tends to embrittle polymers a bit. The radiation environment probably isn't that bad once you get beyond the radiation belt. You do get some coronal mass ejection protons, but it's something that you're going to perhaps want to worry about if you're going to be using a tether system for a long time. A lot of people are thinking of moving toward graphite-based systems or possibly even better, either nanotubes or coiled graphene versions. And some of these look like, in principle, they should have very, very good properties. So far, they're still working on making really good materials with the graphite and the carbon-based materials. But those could be very, very useful things. Again, though, in low orbit, if you get close to the Earth, you're probably going to have to coat the surface of that with some sort of protective layer, possibly as simple as silicon dioxide or maybe aluminum oxide, just to protect the atomic oxygen in the near-Earth environment from degrading the material.
Great. I'll ask one more thing and clear the line in case somebody else wants to call in. You're kind of the go-to guy. Somebody called in a few weeks ago on an open lines show and asked if there was going to be shows about advanced propulsion, and he was recommended to call in to you, and your name comes up fairly often in that kind of setting. Do you have if I could get you in a corner, I'm one of these people who would start spouting my half-baked ideas. And do you get a lot of that? And how do you feel about people having these ideas are sort of out there? And how do you handle all that?
Well, actually, ideas are great. The thing you have to realize is that you need sort of 90 bad ideas before you get those 10 good ideas. And out of those 10 good ideas, only one of them is going to really be worth moving on. So I guess the answer to that question is you need a lot of ideas. And, hey, if you have a lot of ideas, some of them are going to be bad. So the thing is sort of analyze, do the numbers, figure out what you can do, and try to sort the good ideas out from the bad ones. But don't be afraid of bad ideas, because any way you do it, there's going to be more bad ideas than good ideas. That's just the way it is.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kim. So, listeners, that opens the toll-free line is 1-866-687-7223. Jeff, with your permission, I'll skip the break since we have a hard line. But I do want to acknowledge and thank our sponsors for the second segment, which would be Orbital ATK, the global leader that you can count on, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, AIAA, and come to some of their events. Check them out at AIAA.org. And then Celestis, and they have the only successful memorial spaceflight service around, and they've got 5 aggressive launches coming up this year, suborbital, orbital at Vandenberg, as well as the Cape, including on a Falcon Heavy, and they're going back to the moon. So that's assuming the Electron rocket in New Zealand makes it, and it's a new rocket, so one doesn't know about these things, but we all hope that it does make it. So we thank those sponsors very much for being with us here on the Space Show. I have another note, and I've kind of been wrestling with it, but I'm going to go ahead and ask it since it's a topic that has come up on other Space Show programs. So this is Esther in St. Louis. And she says, David, I know you don't want to do UFO things on the show, but you have mentioned them before. I'm really interested in what Dr. Landis might say if he is aware of these fast-moving objects that have been tracked by Navy fighter planes over the Pacific Ocean that have made it into the news in a couple of weeks, including information that Senator Harry Reid had an investigation program going on in the Senate about some of these objects. The pilots have been on many TV stations. The videos have been shown. They certainly move as if they don't have any properties known of any kind of vehicles on Earth. Dr. Landis, are you familiar with these tracked objects? Do you have any thoughts about them?
Yeah, about all I can say is I see the same news sources, but don't really have any more knowledge about them than you do. It's interesting. It would be nice to know what these things are, actually, if they're real or just radar reflections. But I really have no insight. It's something I would really like to see some good hard evidence.
Holding
my hand.
Are there characteristics really that unusual in physics when they say that there's nothing we know of that can do anything like this? Is this really like new physics that would need to explain this, or is this drama queen language or anything that you can ascertain from that?
Well, a lot of it is that when you actually try to find the data, there isn't very much of it. So whenever I try to, you know, drill down and find, oh, what are the actual measurements? Well, the measurements are pretty fuzzy. So what I'd really like to see is, well, I'd like to see some good data before trying to draw any conclusions.
Okay. Well, Esther, that'll probably leave you wanting, but it's the best we're going to be able to do. Bob is in Dallas, Texas. And he says, I know the Deep Space Gateway project is a NASA project, and you work for NASA, but I'm curious as to your thoughts on it, if you can speak freely.
Well, I'm not sure if I have a whole lot to say about Deep Space Gateway. I was involved in some very sort of early study of some lunar missions, but the ideas for lunar missions have been evolving. When Deep Space Gateway started, the idea was, well, we have to do things step by step. And if we're going to build habitats out beyond low Earth orbit, we need a first step. And the idea was that we could build this gateway in one of the Lagrange points, and or orbiting a Lagrange point or perhaps a distant lunar orbit, and it will both give us experience with living beyond the low Earth orbit and also serve as kind of a jumping-off point that we could go to further places from. Beyond that, though, I suspect that you will probably have some further guests coming up in a couple of weeks who maybe could tell more about Deep Space Gateway, because it's not something that I work on currently.
But of course, if you wanted to go to the moon, most of us think we should just go to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And do you get involved in lunar return or lunar settlements? Is that of any real interest to you?
I had been very interested in lunar settlements and lunar resource utilization several years back, trying to answer the question of, well, how can you use the resources on the moon? And it looks like the moon is coming back as a target for exploration. But with that said, I have to say I haven't really looked at lunar resources or lunar settlements for quite a while. There's probably new ideas out there that make it much more exciting, but I haven't been working on that.
So what is the most exciting for you? If you could influence and devise our space policy, what would your top priorities be for human spaceflight?
Oh, there's so many things that are exciting. I'd like to go everywhere. Mars, of course, has been a tempting target for many, many years. The current thinking is that we go to Mars by way of the moon, that we kind of practice some of our technologies going to the moon. But then I'd like to move past Mars. Venus, of course, I think is very interesting. But ultimately, I'd like to see a program that takes humans out even to the Jupiter system and beyond. I don't think we need to stay in the inner solar system. I think we can go everywhere.
So would we be living on spaceships or actually starting settlements on icy moons and things like that?
Well, one of the interesting icy moons is Callisto. What makes Callisto interesting is it's really the only one of the Galilean moons of Jupiter that's pretty much outside the ferocious radiation belt of Jupiter. So Callisto really is a moon that you could think of sending humans to. And, of course, once you've got there, you could dig below the ice. You've got plenty of resources. The number one resource, of course, is ice that you can make oxygen, you can make rocket fuel from. So I keep sort of thinking in the back of my mind, well, Callisto would be a real interesting place to go to as a sort of a settlement, a toehold in the outer solar system.
Does Europa have an interest to you and Enceladus, some of the other places we hear more frequent?
Europa and Enceladus, of course, are the two destinations that really make the astrobiologists get excited. In fact, very recently, we've been working on a project trying to look at the question, well, how hard would it be to melt down through the ice of Europa and get to the ocean that we're quite sure lies below the ice? So the astrobiologists love the idea of exploring Europa. They like Enceladus because Enceladus has geysers that squirt water from the interior all the way out of the gravity well. So they're thinking, well, it might be a way to get a sample of an ocean without having to drill through the ice. So Enceladus is also a very interesting destination. Tricky part about Europa is it is down a little bit closer to Jupiter, and being closer to Jupiter, it's within the fringes of that very ferocious radiation belt. So until you drill down into the ice and get under a bit of ice, Europa is a little bit of a harsh radiation environment. You probably wouldn't want to go outside in a spacesuit for very long. On Europa, you'd want to hide away, perhaps in a cave underneath the ice.
Maybe send a robot down there.
Or maybe send robots down, yeah.
You have another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Doug from Southern California.
Okay.
Just on that point, I understand that we're not to attempt any landing on Europa. Is that right?
Yes, just as Arthur C. Clarke said.
Yeah. Well, you made passing mention about your ideas for using lunar resources, I guess, for maybe a permanent base there. Do you have anything printed or posted on your work on that?
Oh, I have a couple of they're getting old now, relatively old papers looking at how you might be able to use some of the resources on the moon. And, of course, I am far from the only person who studied that idea. There's been a lot of people looking at using lunar resources. One of the things I looked at is the idea of not just making oxygen and rocket fuel, but how you could use some of the materials on the moon to make building materials like metals and glasses and things like that. Even there, I do have to say, other people have looked at that that topic as well.
So did you do this work before or after the 2009 LCROSS mission confirming water at the pole in the permanent shadow craters?
Yeah, most of my work was before that. There is a lot more knowledge of the volatiles of the moon. And, of course, the primary volatile that people are interested in is the water, which we discover, well, back in the Apollo era, we thought the moon was very dry. And now we're saying, well, it's not dry at all. There's a lot of places where there's quite a bit of water in and on the moon.
So given that new information that we've known about for, 9 years now, just off the top of your head, how do you think we should utilize the polar ice?
Well, now that we know that there is water on the moon, it does make the idea of lunar settlements and lunar bases more attractive because there are resources in situ on the surface that you can use for very important things. And again, not just electrolyzing water to make oxygen to breathe, but electrolyzing water to make rocket fuel. What it has sort of changed our thinking is it means that we now do most of our thinking about settlements on the moon very much in either very high northern or very high southern latitudes toward the poles. And that's a very different environment. It's not the environment that Apollo went to. It's something where
right.
The sun will never be very high above the horizon.
And how familiar are you with the peaks of persistent sunlight?
Yes, I look at probably the same graphs of sunlight versus position that you do. And, of course, persistent sunlight is a good term for it. Back when they first were hypothesized, people used to say, well, there must be a mountain of eternal light. Looks like there's no places where there's actually eternal light. Everywhere
right.
you go, there will be some darkness. But there are certainly some high mountains in the very, very high latitudes that have a lot of sunlight.
I think there's some points that get even like above 90%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, persistent sunlight is the term I'm beginning to use now.
Yeah, that's a good term. I like that.
Are you aware of the organics that the LCROSS mission found in the ice?
Yeah, I was aware that they did find more than just water, but some more interesting things. I'd certainly like to send a mission to kind of dig into that ice or permafrost and learn more about it.
Yeah, it's probably not permafrost in the conventional way of thinking about it. The PI for the LCROSS mission, Anthony Colapriet, he indicates that the data seems to suggest it's fluffy and that there's ice crystals mixed in with the fluffy regolith.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would suggest an approach to to harvest in, you know, the ice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the tricky part, of course, is it's in utter darkness, so we've never actually seen it. But perhaps we'll get a better look at it with some of the future missions.
Yeah, well, the Elk Cross mission did eject it into the sunlight.
Yes.
So, you know, you could look at it as actually have seen the polar ice because it was kicked up in the sunlight.
Yeah, indeed. There's an upcoming mission called Lunar Flashlight.
Yeah.
That's going to try and illuminate it and look at it in situ, which would be interesting. It'd be nice to actually get some visuals on the lunar ice. In situ. But you're right. When we've hit it and sprayed it up out into space, we've seen the ejecta.
Yeah. It's a new moon. We've got, you know, different knowledge of about the polar ice deposits. If it's of interest to you, I'd like to encourage you to take a new look at it. Because I really think if you sort of work your way down the list of what's the resources on the moon that you can get first, and that is number one would be propellant. If you could get propellant, force from the moon, that's going to reduce the cost of all your other missions, and it makes your lunar lander reusable, turns it into a lunar ferry. And then if you use that for sanitation and for water for food and for drinking, that's going to knock down a decent percentage of the mass that you ship to the moon. And then if you can get like the micrometeorite bits, separate them out magnetically and melt it and cast and make, you know, bulky parts, then that's going to knock off the amount of mass that you need to ship as well. And you sort of work your way on down to where most of your mass you're producing locally, you know, in situ relatively early on, which makes the issue of sustainability for a base or even moving towards settlement much more plausible.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Thank you for answering my question.
Yeah, indeed. The moon has become much more interesting as we learn more about it. Quite true.
I have an email for you from Bill, who is in Denver. This one says, during today's program, you have probably mentioned maybe close to 50, probably for sure more than 25, really interesting future missions, locations, projects, studies, things to learn about off this planet. The problem is, of course, that they're not happening. There's no money for them. They're not recommended by the groups that recommend missions. So much is wanted to know, and so little is actually done. Have you ever thought about figuring out a more creative way of doing affordable and accessible space missions than the system, which doesn't seem to serve very well today because so many exciting things, just as you have mentioned on the show today, are never, ever going to happen?
Yeah, I wish there were more ways of funding some of these exciting missions. And maybe the 21st century is giving us a bit of a beacon of hope, because we are entering a phase when there are some private organizations that are looking at, certainly at doing rocket launchers, but then perhaps moving in toward missions. So it's possible that there's an alternate way to get some of these missions going that does not rely on the sort of old classic ways. So we can hope. We can hope.
Well, or maybe there's a way that the missions turn around and somehow pay for themselves or provide some kind of revenue stream where the reason for doing them may not be purely science, but the science is definitely beneficial and important.
Yes.
But creative people like you need to put your minds to it.
Well, we've been getting a lot of interest in ways of getting into space that would be cheaper. And that will certainly open up a lot if we can just make it cheaper to get into space. It'll allow people to make missions and perhaps take risks, allow failures. If it doesn't cost $100 million to get into orbit, maybe you can try something that's a little bit risky with a high return. but also taking some chance of failure. That's the way we learn, is by making mistakes.
Are there any advanced propulsion ideas for getting off of Earth's gravity well, other than, say, a Falcon Heavy rocket or a SpaceX rocket? Is there anything other than a rocket that you've thought about or seen proposed or is bandied around?
Well, I've certainly thought about a lot of people. I've seen a lot of people propose things, and I've thought about a lot of ideas. In the near term, well, people are looking at rockets, and I guess with Stratolauncher, the idea of a rocket that's carried by an airplane. I've always personally been sort of fascinated via the idea that you might be able to make an exo-atmospheric tower, actually a tower built up from the ground that would put you above most of the atmosphere. There's been a handful of people looking at that idea, but not a whole lot of serious contemplation of it. Other than that, man, it's that first 100 miles and that first 7 kilometers a second that's the hardest part. Once you get that first bit into orbit, well, you're halfway to anywhere.
Absolutely, but you got to get through that first part of it somehow with something.
Yes, that's the hard part.
What else would interest you if you were the planning czar? I mean, would you rate Mars over Venus, or would you say we should be doing more Venus work than Mars, for example?
Oh, that's like asking me which one of the children is the favorite child. I like Venus and Mars. There's exciting stuff going on in Mars as well. But, man, I'd like to see some more missions to Venus. It has been the neglected planet. So I'd say we should at least put a little bit of effort into looking at our evil twin sister, Venus.
Penny is in Billings, Montana, and she says, your best guess, or perhaps you know, has there been or is there some kind of simple life on Mars?
That is the question, the answer to which is nobody knows. We have been sort of characterizing the environment of Mars, and we're pretty sure now that in the distant past, Mars was a very warm and wet world and should have been hospitable to life. We don't know how life evolved. We don't know what... We know that life did evolve, but we don't know how it started in the very first place, the very origin of life. So we can't really answer the question of would that same process have happened on Mars as well. I'm still optimistic. I'm still optimistic that, oh, if we look at Mars long enough, we may find evidence of past life, and a long shot, maybe even evidence of present life, probably in bacterial form. But that's really a kind of a long shot. It's the true scientific answer is we don't know. We really have to learn more.
So Penny has a part B, which I will now bring up, and she said, better shot at finding past life or current life on Mars, or finding an exoplanet that has possible life on it?
Well, we are discovering exoplanets at a great rate, but the difficulty of discovering an exoplanet that's hospitable to life is that it's hard to learn much about them because you get so few photons from an exoplanet that it's hard to build up much information about what the potential biosphere of an exoplanet would be. We don't even know for sure what the spectroscopic signature of a biosphere is. We've sort of made a lot of educated guesses, but we don't really know the signature of a biosphere. Of course, if we saw something like chlorofluorocarbons, freon in the atmosphere of a biosphere, of an exoplanet, we'd say, hey, there's a civilization there. But, man, it's going to be very hard to characterize the biosphere of an exoplanet. So I'd say say if you're looking for extraterrestrial life at the moment, well, look at Mars, look at Europa, look at Enceladus, look at Venus even. But it's going to be a long time before we learn enough about exoplanets to be able to definitively say whether there's a biosphere.
I have another question. This is probably going to be the last one of the show. Jack is in New Orleans, and he says, Dr. Landis, you are certainly known for creative ideas on interstellar flight and possibilities. There seems to be private money pouring into this field through Breakthrough and Uri Milner and maybe some other programs. Are you seeing this field moving forward at anything more than a snail's pace? Is there anything to the ideas of using laser propulsion to get up to maybe a third the speed of light for microwafers? Do you see any possibility that we're going to see this type of flight take root in the near future?
Yeah, well, things like the Breakthrough Starshot project have really breathed new life into the ideas of very small interstellar probes. That and the fact that we're beginning to learn there are targets out there, or there are places that we might want to go and get a close-up look. I talked about how hard it is to detect a biosphere at interstellar distances. Well, one solution to that problem is go there. So the answer is yes, there has been a lot of recent interest in looking at interstellar spy flight, and specifically with the idea of very, very low-mass microspaceships, in fact, nanospaceships, that could be pushed by lasers. With that, we've also been learning a little bit about how hard it is. But the technologies are getting better. The laser technology that was really very much science fiction when I did most of my work on the project back in the late 1990s is getting there. We have very much better laser technology now than we did back then. So I think, you know, the possibility of an actual interstellar probe being launched, a microprobe, a nanoprobe, is a very real possibility of that happening in our lifetime, and that would be infinitely cool. That really is the ultimate exploration.
If we're around for the return of the information.
Yes, of course, then it takes a couple of years for the
well,
for the information to come back.
Given that, do you think SETI is a good way to be doing a search for extraterrestrial life?
Well, you might as well. It's possible. Back on Enrico Fermi said, well, the universe should be teeming with life. Where are they? Why can't we hear them? Well, we can only hear people if they're talking very loud. But if we keep looking, maybe we'll find out there somewhere people are talking very loud.
I don't know. We don't seem to hear people talking to us at dinner, do we? So you have another question from outside the country. It's not quite interstellar, but it is across the pond from Sweden. From Bijan, what do you think of atmospheric sample return missions, probes flying through the upper atmosphere or plume of a planet or moon to capture some material and returning it to Earth? Would it answer key questions?
Yeah, I have seen people propose some of those missions. Of course, we did a very similar mission once. We did the Stardust mission, where we flew through the plume of a comet to bring little samples of dust back from the comet. Was that Stardust?
Yeah.
For a planet instead of a comet, it's harder because, of course, if you come in on a low approach to a planet, you're still moving at greater than orbital velocity. So you grab a sample moving pretty fast. But it's not out of the question that you could grab some very interesting samples. Might be a really interesting way to look at Venus if some of those ultraviolet absorbers are lofted up high enough into the atmosphere that you could get them. But with that said, when you hit things at this speeds of like 10 kilometers a second or faster, you have to really worry whether the samples that you get might not get altered by the way that you collect them. So I'd like to see a good proposal and see what happens.
Would you worry about the Andromeda strain getting back to Earth, or do you dismiss that?
Well, just to be cautious, you probably want to examine extraterrestrial samples in a moderately secure biological laboratory, just on the very, very unlikely chance that there would be something biologically active. From the point of view of evolution, you would think that any sort of life that has evolved to live in the upper atmosphere of Venus is not going to take over the Earth. And life that can live in the upper atmosphere of Venus would look at Earth and say, oh, my God, there's something wrong with this planet. There's no acid here.
You taste terrible, right?
Yeah. Where's the acid? I need acid. But so I think it's a very, very, very long shot. It's just our environment is different than the environment of Mars. It's different than the environment of Venus, and bacteria would be evolved to live in the environment that they live in. But I can see the point in being prudent and making sure that when you first open the container, you're opening it in a laboratory that's not exposed to the biosphere.
Anything we should have talked about today that we've forgotten or omitted or that you wanted to say?
Well, that's funny. I thought we were going to talk about the NIAC concepts of going to the outer solar system, to Saturn's moon Titan and to Triton and perhaps even to Pluto. But looked like we stayed in the inner solar system this time.
Well, that's where the listeners started in with questions and phone calls, and they never stopped. So I guess that's what was on people's minds, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that gives us something for the next time, maybe.
Yes.
Next time I won't turn the phones on until we're through with the NIAC concept.
Well, it's always fun to listen to the questions.
Thank you very much for being with us again today. It's really good to talk to you, and we appreciate your being here.
Okay, well, thank you. This was fun.
Okay, and hopefully we can do it again down the road. So.
Okay, excellent.
All of you have a great rest of the week, and you too, Dr. Landis, and goodbye from the Space Show.
Okay, goodbye to all.